include RASAT-1, which we launched, OTSAT, which was for Amir Kabir University and was designed and manufactured by the university, and it was launched. There was SharifSat, which was manufactured by Sharif University and then launched.
Iran has established the technological basis for designing, building, launching and operating satellites in low Earth orbit at an altitude of under 2,000 kilometers, that is. It has placed a handful of satellites, including the Sinar-1 and Nur-1 and 2 in low Earth orbit, as well as the Omid, the Rasad, the Navid and the Fajr-5. Omid, meaning hope, is Iran's first domestically made satellite, which was placed in orbit by an indigenous launcher, Safir, in 2009. Now, since the Khayyam is suspected as a bogeyman by some, I've got to say the forces basically pursue their own effort. Say the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, IRGC, has its own space venture, which is for security surveillance and defense purposes. IRGC Aerospace Chief Amir Ali Hajizadeh announced that the IRGC plans to launch another satellite into orbit before the end of the current Iranian year in March 2023. Iran's goals in space have remained fairly consistent over time. These goals are similar to those of any and all other spacefaring or space-savvy nations with their inherently dual-use satellites, which can be used for civilian or military purposes, in other words. For example, the U.S. government-owned GPS, Global Positioning System, which gives essential navigation information to civilians and the U.S. military. Technically speaking, Iran seeks to have a persistent presence of satellites in low Earth orbit and to place a satellite into geostationary orbit by the spring of 2026. Geostationary orbit is an altitude of approximately 36,000 kilometers. Separately, Iran is working to send an astronaut to space by the spring of 2032, Iran Prima reports. The IRGC program originally may have focused on developing long-range rockets, but its goals have evolved over time, and now they more closely resemble the state-run space program, including services that would benefit civilians. Regardless of all, the U.S. government has made every effort to link Iran's space launches to UN Security Council Resolution 2231 to say Iran is in breach of that resolution. Whereas Resolution 2231 was made to endorse the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, on Iran's peaceful nuclear program of 2015, it has nothing to do with this country's space and satellite program. The U.S. anyhow imposed sanctions on Iran's civilian space agency and two research organizations in 2019, alleging they were being used to advance this country's ballistic missile program.
Regarding military applications, well, it's obvious that once you have the footage, you can use it in any manner that you see fit. Everything in life has two sides, like water. Man cannot live without water, but it can turn into a flood and ruins a village's livelihood. Everything on the planet that affects humanity has two sides. If some organizations want, they can use this footage for military purposes, and it's natural. But the objective of this satellite in the contract was not for military use.
I don't know about this issue. I mean, the thing is that, I mean, for military purpose, there are currently many more satellites which provide imagery with better spatial and temporal resolutions. Yeah. So the Khayyam has a spatial resolution of 1 meter, and we need to consider just one satellite. So it doesn't have a very high, for it doesn't provide a daily or hourly image. You know, this is what you need, you know, for such applications. So, but I think with data from, if the authorities, you know, continue investment on this technology, and by launching more satellites, they can make a sort of new constellation. And this will help reduce the revisit time of this mission.
Iran's interest in outer space dates back to 1957, when it joined 17 other nations in creating the Ad Hoc Committee for International Cooperation in Space at the United Nations. The sum of all efforts has been that Iran has achieved a complete space technology cycle in the international arena, as confirmed in 2020 by Iranian Space Agency Chief Mortaza Baradi. This was achieved in spite of US sanctions and the very real problems they have caused, such as SWIFT having disconnected Iran's banks last year. To come back down to earth, I'll have to wrap it up here, as that's all we've got time for. But thanks from the whole team. Till next time, bye.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light, and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. In such a program, we criticize movies with especially religious themes. Of course, we criticize them not from the artistic or purely artistic facet. Rather, we deal with these movies and critique it or criticize these movies, in fact, based on their contents and how much truth can we find in them, or we can compare them with some of the religious teachings we have, and also logic. Well, for that, again, I invited Sayyid Abdullah and Sister Asma. Assalamu alaikum to you both. Sayyid Abdullah, I started with you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you.
You're welcome. And Sister Asma, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. I have the pleasure to be here again.
The pleasure is all mine. And let's take a listen to a short part of this movie, Jinn, 2014, American horror movie directed by Ajmal Zahir Ahmad. Let's listen and then we'll be back. Don't go away.
I thought you gave that up
a long time ago.
Coming close to death, can have an effect.
You could have gone Christian, you know.
Point is, something happened. As if something wasn't letting me go.
Well, there's nothing strange about that. I see that in my business all the time.
I don't.
You were guarding that boy since he was a child without him ever knowing it. You think something was guarding you as well?
Hard to believe.
That's why we call them miracles.
Back to the program, Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. With me, Mohammad Jad, hosting this program, and Sister Asma and Sayyid Abdullah, my guest speaker in the studio, criticizing the movie Jinn, produced in 2014, directed by Ajmal Zahir Ahmad, starring Dominic Raines, Ray Park, William Atherton, Farah Tahir, and Surinder Swan. Well, in that specific part, well, we see, in fact, the father talking, let's say, to Gabriel, who has a necklace of the Star of David, Sayyid Abdullah, on his neck, and gives him a symbol of a mixed crescent. It's very interesting to have all of these symbols of different religions mixed into or boiled into one. The Star of David and a cross. It's like a medal, of course, right? Mm. The location is a temple, if you notice.
Yeah.
Right? Having the settings of a church, synagogue, and a mosque all together.
Yeah.
All right? Well, does this film advocate peace with the help of all the major religions of the world?
You just reminded me of a scene from the movie The Mummy.
Remember there's a scene where the mummy try he comes to life and there's this guy, the guide, and then he tries to see what religion the mummy is. And so he had all these necklaces. Mm-hmm. He had the Jewish, the cross, the Star of David. So some people, they try to incorporate all these things together to make it easier for the viewers to kind of get into the spirit of the movie. If it was just from a Christian theology, the Muslims would be left out. They wouldn't like it. If it was just a Muslim kind of theme, the Christians wouldn't like it. And so on, so with the Jews. So they try to incorporate everything in a very nice, smooth way, I can say. Like the way they put the cross and the Star of David and everything else. It was just an easier kind of smooth transaction between all these things put together. I think that was just
not to mess with any religion.
Yeah, I don't think
or make an enemy of them.
Exactly, and followers. I don't think
it has, and at the end of the day, make a lot of money.
Exactly, exactly. And I think
by appeasing to them.
Yeah, so at the end of the day, I don't think it was more like of a peace thing between religions, rather than trying to say that this concept of jinn and stuff like that is within all these religions. Mm-hmm. All these religions deal with this issue, and they all have it. Therefore, it will be only appropriate to have all of them at the same time.
Yes. Sister Asma, do you believe that there are more common realities and concepts in religions than their distinguishing factors, that the differences? Why do we see, for example, in the world, like they too much highlight, for example, the differences among religions, as if they have this intention of making a fight between all their followers. Rather, we should focus on the common denominators.
Exactly. I think all the religions are the same, and they have been united in Islam.
They
after
have come
all,
from
eventually.
The same root.
Yes, they have the same root, and they speak about the same things.
God.
If it's peace, if it's about justice, if it's about good deeds or whatever... It is in all the religions, in all the holy books, we see that we have been advised to do these good things or exclude ourselves from some bad rituals or whatever, or they have enlightened us all. So I think all the religions are the same, but by the passage of the time, as we get into the modern age, since different sort of government come into existence, then based on their benefits, they would bring these differences into existence in a way that people would get into a fight with each other.
Yeah,
but at the end of the day, all the religions are the same.
This is one good, let's say, theme and thing, let's say, that I've seen in this movie, and I pretty much liked it. And to me, if you bring all of the prophets together, because they have come from the same origin,
exactly,
and they worship the same God, I don't think that they would get into a fight with each other,
exactly,
like their followers.
Yes, just when human beings come into the story and they bring their ego with them, all the troubles or the fights are going to rush up.
Mm-hmm, I see. Let's take a short break by listening to part of the movie Jinn, or a trailer from it, produced in 2014, directed by Ajmal Zahir Ahmad. Then we'll be back. Don't go away.
They've been around for a long time, and some of them want the world back.
Some people believe if you talk about the jinn, they will come to you.
Weird stuff is happening to us, Mom. I don't know if it's a prank, whether or not to believe these guys.
Come here.
They come generation after generation, looking for the prophesied one.
Oh my God. Something's coming.
Back to the program, Viewpoint on RIB English Radio. With me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sister Asma and Sayyid Abdullah, my guest speaker, helping me criticizing the movie Jinn, produced in 2014, directed by Ajmal Zahir Ahmad. Well, Sayyid Abdullah, at the end of the movie, they all realize that Sean and Jasmine's newborn son also has a superpower, right? By pulling the pacifier, the baby's dummy, basically, without touching it. Are such abilities for real, Sayyid Abdullah, or just a magic trick in the media for more entertainment?
That scene reminded me of the cartoon The Incredibles when they realized at the end of the movie that they
exactly
their powers as well.
Yeah, look, it did to me too.
Yeah. Look, human beings, we have the ability to bend and mend the reality that we live in. Mm-hmm. We do have the capacity.
Yes.
Not that we don't. We do, but we just don't know how. We haven't reached that full capacity of our brain to use it. And that's why I always refer to the movie Lucy. If you remember.
Yes, I do.
If we
criticize it too, by the way.
Yeah. So if we reach 100% of our capacity, we can change things around us. I mean, you know, when we talk about the Imams alayhi salam being able to, for example, Amir al-Mu'mineen, to move the sun backwards and forwards and to shift things around earth, it's because they have, not because they have just, you know, magical powers, it's because they have the know-how. Even Allah in the Quran says, when he talks about jinn and ins, he said, if you want to leave the realms of earth, you can do that. In sata'tum and tanfudu fanfudu. You can.
Yeah.
La tanfudu illa bisultan. You need knowledge to be able to do so.
Exactly.
So human beings, we can shift and move things without even having to move a thing.
But we haven't actualized our potential.
Exactly. So we need to learn how to. I mean, for you to borrow these gifts to move things around, no, that's just nonsense.
I see.
That was the childhood of Superman.
Yeah, exactly. So that's just Hollywood at its best.
Yeah.
Sister Asma, you know, Muslims relate jinns to fire, but Western movies I've noticed, color blue in lots of their movies, especially cartoons. If they want to show that there is a demon or a genie or whatever, they paint it blue, all right? But we all know that it's not basically blue according to the documents, the evidence we have from the Holy Scriptures. And even in this movie, it has been reiterated several times that they are made of fire, basically, all right? Mm-hmm. Even you could see it in the movie because it was showing like they were like molten fire when you look at their faces, you know? So is there any reason that we see such a huge like distortion, a twist of fact that if you will, of course, that they become blue?
Not as far as I know. Not that I've been told of. I don't know. Maybe they have something in their culture or any special thing.
Mm-hmm. Sayyid Abdullah, any comment?
When it comes to blue, I think it depends on how they use it, though. If you're talking about genie in Aladdin.
Even that one was blue.
It was blue, yeah. So sometimes the blue is in reference to desires, right? So they use the color blue. Where we use it in a different form, we use it in a different fear, right? So to prove something, it's very scary and very dangerous. So we use the yellowish kind of orangish kind of color to represent these things. We're trying to bring forward the scary kind of feel.
Mm-hmm.
Where in a Western culture, even with colors, it's a trick on the mind, though. They play that trick. Mm-hmm. So this is also personal. This is what I think. Like, it's just not, I mean, I haven't had a deep look into it. It's just like they trigger, with the color blue trigger certain things in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
So they put them in your mind that later on they might trigger things.
I see.
So, yeah.
And also we see another theme quite like prevalent kind of, you know, in the movies I've seen, except for a few like Conjuring, for example, it may in fact take different forms of human beings, you know.
Yeah.
The thing is the genies are usually like, you know, getting to the bodies of like the girls and kids. We also see this like based on some kind of personal experiences that I had with certain guys who claim to have like or purported to have some kind of contact with such phenomenon, you know, and they, you know, usually use the kid actually to contact, for example, that are mentioned. And is there any reason why they choose, for example, either girls or the kids? If it's a boy, it's a kid, basically, not a, you know, an adult.
Yeah.
Any reason for this?
The reason is, they have a reason. The reason is that they look for purity, because with these things, to make a connection, you need purity. So with boys get polluted very quickly in terms of akhlaq, in terms of morality, in terms of the thing they do. Mm-hmm. So they have to get them young. with girls, usually, even when they get older, they still maintain their purity as long as they are still single. You know what I mean? So they use them mainly. And even you see that trend of women being a sacrifice for the lords, you know, at this
especially
stage
they
of
use
being,
the virgins.
Being virgins. Because they represent purity themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so they use that in the sense of purity.
Oh, that's the reason then.
Yeah.
I see. Purity.
Purity.
Okay, thank you very much for your nice contribution. Finally, at last, we have come to the end of criticizing this movie. Of course, I know there are lots of questions about genies and such weird, let's say, supernatural stuff. But the thing is, we can't afford the time really to deal with all of those issues. And we take it very slow by, like, for example, you know, working and criticizing on such movies to somehow hopefully shed some light to the best of our ability and knowledge, of course.
Hopefully.
Thank you very much for listening. And thank you both of you, Sister Asma and Sayyid Abdullah.
Pleasure.
And thank you, my dear audience, for listening to this program, Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. We leave you in Allah's care, so please pray for us too. Thank you.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
حضرت زهرا محور معصومینه هر جا باشه بقیه هستن
حضرت فاطمه's character is like a pillar and pivots among the infallibles as we read in the famous poem O Fatima the heaven of Ahmad O Fatima the laylatul qadr of Muhammad O Fatima from Muhammad to Mahdi everyone chants your name loudly O Fatima
نسبت به حضرت زهرا همشون جور دیگری بودن خب این حضرت زهرای بزرگوار قبرش مخفیه
All the infallibles knew the special position of Hazrat Fatima. Now, the grave of this lady is unknown. We, in order to benefit from the blessings of Hazrat Fatima, must visit the tomb of Lady Masuma. The believers can't be deprived from the blessings of the tomb of Hazrat Fatima. In other words, Hazrat Masuma's tomb is the bridge to Hazrat Fatima's light of soul. Therefore, all the souls of the Ahl Bayt are present at the tomb of Lady Fatimatul Masuma in Qom too. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, which was the English translation of a short Persian speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
In the limelight.
Concrete efforts and not cosmetic measures are required to end the plight of the Rohingya Muslims, says Kayhan International staff writer in an article published under the heading Onus on UN to End Plight of Rohingya Refugees. Stay tuned for more. Concrete efforts and not cosmetic measures are required to end the plight of the Rohingya Muslims, whether they're refugees who have sought temporary asylum abroad, such as the million odd languishing in camps in Bangladesh, or those still living in their once flourishing homeland under persecution, torture, and periodic bouts of genocide. The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, who toured refugee camps in Bangladesh recently and met groups of Rohingyas, should realize the gravity of the situation of these displaced people, deprived of normal life, including education for children. It is rather a belated visit to the Rohingya refugee camps by Michelle Bachelet, a former Chilean president who has been UN High Commissioner for Human Rights since 2018. Nevertheless, it is a welcome visit in view of the bright record of Ms. Bachelet, both during her 2 4-year terms as president of Chile that saw promotion of literacy amongst hundreds of thousands of poor families through distribution of free briefcases, including books, including encyclopedias, dictionaries, poetry works and books, and her castigation of Saudi Arabia for its war crimes in Yemen, as well as her criticism of the Zionist regime for the recent killing of journalist Shirin Abu Akleh. She had said, chronically, high levels of killings and injuries of Palestinians, including children by Israeli forces in the occupied Palestinian territory, have continued. These documented words of the UN High Commissioner of Human Rights are indeed soothing for the Rohingya refugees who have not seen anything of note done by the world body or the so-called advocates of democracy. Bachelet, during her 4-day visit, has met Bangladesh Foreign, Home, Law and Education Ministers and also Shamsud Duza, the host country's Deputy Refugee Relief and Repatriation Commissioner, as well as human rights activists and NGOs who briefed her about the situation in Bangladesh. While appreciating Bangladesh's humanitarian gesture towards the Rohingyas, Bachelet, a physician by profession and a committed socialist, underscored the need for the education of refugees through the learning centers in the camps, as well as proper sanitary measures. This is indeed a positive development for Rohingya refugees who are in sore need of education for children and young adults, in addition to adequate health and hygienic amenities. If Bachelet, who has met with Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina before wrapping up her visit, could implement education and health programs for the refugees in coordination with the government of Bangladesh, she would have done a great job. It is the duty of the UN to highlight the atrocities of the Myanmar regime while taking concrete steps to repatriate the Rohingyas to their homeland with guarantee that their birthright will never again be violated. Hopefully, Bachelet will succeed in view of her record as president of Chile in opening in Santiago the Museum of Memory and Human Rights, documenting the horrors of General Augusto Pinochet's 16.5-year U.S.-backed dictatorship, and her making the Chilean Army Chief General Juan Emilio Chere to sign the Never Again Declaration in 2003 that the military will never subvert democracy in Chile.
7. They're under pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Bookshelf with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim, on IRIB English Radio. One of the personalities that, unfortunately, within the English language, there is not a lot of material on, is a person who played a great role. Again, obviously, historical discussions need to be analyzed a bit further. But in general, a role before the event of Karbala, and a role especially, and more importantly, after the event of Karbala. And that person is Mukhtar al-Thaqafi. And we all know of the serial that was produced regarding this individual, a serial that has a lot of important historical instances and incidents and anecdotes in it. Obviously, not everything in a serial, in a kind of series is true. Obviously, they had to make it to look like that. But there are a lot of important things within it that are very historically accurate. But unfortunately, in written English, there's very few sources. One of the first books that I myself came across with this topic is the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today, inshallah. And it's a book, again, as the culture of, you know, the majalis and of the gatherings of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is, many of these gatherings that the scholar delivers lectures and delivers the speech, they are then, you know, recorded, they are then, you know, typed and set into a written form. So the book that we would like to introduce, similar to the one we introduced in one of our previous programs, is a set of lectures that were then compiled, collected, and then translated into English. So inshallah, please join us for the introduction of this book in our next segment, inshallah.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd. Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats in chanty whisper. I say, why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name? I say, I say.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today is titled Amir Mukhtar Rahmatullah Alayh, Lectures of Shah-e-Karbala Trust, Imam Baghi-Rizviya Society. And these lectures were delivered in the year 1998. These lectures were delivered by Sayyid Hassan Zafar Naqvi, and they were then translated by Dur Shahwar Jafari. And obviously, from the title and from the place of, you know, the lectures, we can quite easily understand that the original language of these lectures were Urdu. The book was then published by Mahfuz Book Agency, which is also based in Karachi, Pakistan, obviously. So basically, this book is a set of 9 lectures that were delivered by the author at that particular Imam Barga. Imam Barga obviously is Husseiniya, or a place or a center where the gatherings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam is performed, or where people gather in order to remember the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam. So the author obviously, in the beginning of his lecture, speaks about the history of Mukhtar, rahmatullah alayh. He gives the history of before Karbala, after Karbala, and what Mukhtar did after Karbala. And obviously at the end of each lecture, he does the maqtal, or the reciting of the mourning and reciting of the events of Karbala in order to make people cry. So in this particular book as well, you see that the author will obviously start with the history and then continue throughout the lectures on the history, and then obviously go to the reciting of the heart-rending events of Karbala, but obviously referring it back to some of the events that are relevant to the title of Mukhtar. And as I mentioned, this is one of the first books that I myself came across that deals with the subject. There is another book that deals with this, but it's a very smaller book, and hopefully, inshallah, in one of our next sessions, we will be able to introduce that book, which is also about Mukhtar al-Thaqafi, to our dear listeners. But right now, this is a book that we want to introduce. Again, it is called Amir Mukhtar. It is a set of 9 lectures that have been translated from Urdu to English, delivered by Sayyid Hassan Zafar Naqvi and translated by Durre Shahwar Jafari. And obviously, inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be reading a portion of this book for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasir Ibrahim. The book that we introduce to our dear listeners today is titled Amir Mukhtar, Rahmatullah Alayh, a set of 9 lectures that were delivered by Sayyid Hassan Zafar Naqvi in Pakistan, obviously originally delivered in Urdu, translated into English then by Durre Shahwar Jafari, and then published in Karachi by Mahfuz Book Agency. So we will be reading from the first lecture, obviously, because these lectures kind of flow from one another, so it will not be beneficial to start from, example, lecture 3 and then I'll leave out the rest of them. So the recital begins with the following verse of the Holy Quran from Surah Ahzab, Surah 33, verse number 23. Among the believers are men who have been true to their covenant with God. Of them some have completed their vow and some await, but they have never changed in the least. Dear audience, the topic is before you. Insha'Allah, I shall be talking to you about Amir Mukhtar for 9 days. Today is the introductory speech. I have to tell you certain things. Firstly, the reason for the selection of this topic. Usually it happens that a discussion about Amir Mukhtar, rahmatullah alayh, is left for the end, i.e. in Rabi al-Awwal. Even then, only Mukhtar Name is read. In a way, that is also fulfilling the obligation. However, the reason I had in mind when I selected this topic was that Muharram is at its peak. During the first month and up till the Chahlum, Chahlum means the 40th after the day of Ashura, basically the Arba'in. There is more fervor. After the Chahlum, it is natural that as the days of mourning are towards the end, by the 8th of Rabi al-Awwal, the mourning ends. One can see by the crowd in the procession that mu'mineen are busy in the programs planned after 8th of Rabi al-Awwal. That is why, in my humble opinion, the jihad of Amir Mukhtar, rahmatullah alayh, cannot be given due importance during those days. Respected Amir Mukhtar, rahmatullah alayh, the great historical character, don't see him only as a prediction and prayer of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Mawla'i Kainat alayhi salam, that is Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, and Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, and think that it is
the only reason that we have to talk about him. Dear audience, in order to get a proper historical perspective, we shall have to enter the atmosphere prevailing in the Kufa of those days. We shall have to reach the people of that era. It is not that the Kufa were a weird nation. Nowadays, whoever breaches faith is called a Kufi. It has almost become a metaphor. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to truly understand the personality of Mukhtar with research. Again, this book is based on the research and the opinions of this humble Sayyid. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless his efforts. And may we also be of those who partake in the gatherings of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and truly understand the personalities who played a great role in this historical and unique and unmatched event. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Ignoring abuses by Ukrainian forces gives them a free hand to commit crimes not only against Russian soldiers but also against the large number of Ukrainians who are not seen as loyal to Kiev. says Jonathan Cook, author, in an article published under the heading, Why is Amnesty apologizing for telling the truth about Ukrainian war crimes? Stay tuned for more. Should a human rights organization apologize for publishing important evidence of war crimes and human rights abuses? If it does apologize, what does that suggest about its commitment to this passionately uncovering the truth about the actions of parties to the war? And equally, that message does it send to those who claim to be distressed by the publication of such evidence? Those are questions Amnesty International should have pondered far more carefully than it obviously did before issuing an apology last week over its latest report on the war in Ukraine. In that report, Amnesty accused Ukrainian forces of committing war crimes by stationing troops and artillery in or near schools, hospitals, and residential buildings, thereby using civilians effectively as human shields. Such practices by Ukrainian soldiers were identified in 19 different towns and villages. These incidents did not just theoretically endanger civilians. There is evidence, according to Amnesty, that return fire on these Ukrainian positions led to non-combatants being killed. The Israeli regime army regularly accuses Palestinian resistance movements of hiding among civilians in Gaza, while obscuring its own long-documented practice of using Palestinians as human shields. But whatever the truth of the Zionist regime's claims, unlike the tiny and massively overcrowded Gaza, which offers few or no hiding places outside of built-up areas for Palestinian fighters to resist Israeli regime aggression, Amnesty concluded of the situation in Ukraine, viable alternatives were available that would not endanger civilians, such as military bases or densely wooded areas nearby, or other structures further away from residential areas. In other words, it was a choice made by the Ukrainian army to put its own civilians in harm's way. Notably, this is the first time a major Western human rights organization has publicly scrutinized the behavior of Ukraine's troops. The pushback against the latest report was relentless, coming even from Amnesty's own Ukrainian team. Oksana Pokalchuk, its head, quit, explaining that her team did everything they could to prevent this material from being published. Under mounting pressure, Amnesty made a statement last week in which it said it deeply regrets the distress and anger caused by its report, while at the same time stating, we fully stand by our findings. Faulty lines of communication mean orders are misunderstood or only partially relayed to those on the front lines. There are technical malfunctions, inevitably. Soldiers prioritize their own lives over those of the enemy, including civilians. Terrorizing the other side through human rights violations can be an effective way to avoid combat by sending a warning to enemy soldiers to desert their post and civilians to flee. Sadists and psychopaths, meanwhile, find themselves with plenty of opportunities to exploit during the fighting. But conversely, parties to wars invariably struggle to acknowledge their own abuses. They prefer simple-minded, self-serving narratives of good and evil. Our soldiers are heroes, morally spotless, while their soldiers are barbarians, indifferent to the value of human life. Western governments and establishment media outlets have readily peddled this foolish line in Ukraine too, even though neither Europe nor the United States are opposed to be directly involved in the war. In such circumstances, only the human rights community is in a position to provide a more faithful picture of how events are unfolding and hold to account the site for its crimes. But until Amnesty stepped out of line, Western human rights groups had moved in lockstep with Western governments, the same governments that appear to want endless war in Ukraine to weaken Russia rather than a quick resolution. Even the author of Amnesty's new report, Donatella Rovera, has conceded, "I think the level of self-censorship on this issue, Ukrainian war crimes, has been pretty extraordinary. Amnesty should not be apologizing for providing a rare window on such crimes by Ukrainian forces. Amnesty's apology sends a message to those partisans trying to shut down a scrutiny of Ukrainian crimes of just how easy it is to put the human rights community on the defensive. Efforts to deter reporting of a similar nature in the future will intensify." Turning a blind eye of Ukrainian crimes also lifts the pressure on Western governments. They have been recklessly channeling arms worth many billions of dollars to Ukraine, even though they have little idea where most end up. In a further worrying sign of self-censorship in the West, CBS recently postponed the broadcast of an investigation suggesting as little as a third of Western weapons reach their intended destination in Ukraine. That is all the more dangerous because even before late February, Ukrainian forces, including the neo-Nazi elements now glossed over in Western narratives, were engaged in a vicious civil war with ethnic Russian communities in Ukraine's east. That region, the Donbas, is where Moscow has been focusing its military advances. Human rights violations by Ukrainians against other Ukrainians were regularly committed during the 8-year civil war, as Western monitors documented at the time. Such crimes are almost certainly continuing under cover of the war against Russia, but with the aid now of Western arms shipments. Ignoring abuses by Ukrainian forces gives them a free hand to commit crimes not only against Russian soldiers, but also against the large number of Ukrainians who are not seen as loyal to Kiev. A failure to closely scrutinize how and where Western artillery is being used is almost certain to result in more, not less, of the kind of Ukrainian crimes Amnesty has just highlighted. Western governments and publics need to be confronted with the likely consequences of flooding the battlefield with weapons before they prefer such a policy over pursuing diplomatic solutions. Ultimately, allowing one side only to be criticized for its crimes, reinforcing the simple-minded narrative of good guys versus bad guys, is likely to fuel the war rather than resolve it. Amnesty's conduct over this latest report is not exceptional. It is part of a pattern of behavior by a Western human rights community vulnerable to political and financial pressures that detract from its ostensible mission. There has long been a revolving door between the staff of prominent human rights groups and the U.S. government, and pressure from elite donors who are invested in these dominant narratives doubtless plays a part too. Whatever the truth of that claim, it presented a very one-sided picture of what took place during that summer's fighting. Music. Neither Amnesty nor Human Rights Watch responded